Fran, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay. You may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. This case involves signing a summons, and the defendant was the appellant was charged with both forging the public document and uttering the public document. And at the conclusion of the trial, the judge found him guilty of both, and the defendant appealed the convictions for uttering on the theory that he didn't receive anything in exchange for the signing. And so the analogy, I think, for forging and uttering is sort of always the check analogy. And the definitions in the cases are that uttering is an assertion by word or action that a writing known to be forged is good and valid. But that's the definition that the Attorney General cites. But that's not all. And that's why Bennett and Sands are important, because if that were true, then on the analogy of the check, the telling a friend that you had a forged check just to impress them would be an uttering. And I don't think that is legally an uttering, because it requires something more. It requires the participation in that fraud of the forgery. And so Bennett cites this old case of Sands, which has maybe somewhat awkward language, but I think language that is consistent with, for example, the model jury instruction and other things, where it says it's any assertion or declaration by word or act, directly or indirectly, that the writing is good, the forged writing is good, with the knowledge and intent, provided that such assertion was made in the prosecution of the purpose of obtaining the object mentioned in the writing. So there's this sort of intent requirement that you have to be getting something. Bennett cites Wharton's criminal law. In addition to that, it says a forged instrument is uttered when it's offered to another as genuine without regard to whether it's so accepted. But the criminal, the model jury instruction also includes as an element an intent to defraud. That getting some benefit from it. And I think that is what's happening here, is that the person's being given a summons, they're being asked to sign it. There's nothing on the face of the summons that explains anything about what they're doing except for offering a signature and a promise to appear.
Aaron,
promise.
Judge Fields, you talk about here he's not really getting anything in exchange for his forged signature here, so therefore it's not an uttering. But doesn't he get at least one of two things here? If he signs it, of course, whether he signs it with his own name or with Christopher Venable, he doesn't have to go with the officer to see the magistrate, because if he refuses to sign it, he's going to not be allowed to go on his way. And also, if he signs the name Chris Venable as opposed to his own name, then what he gets is Mr. Venable is then the person charged with speeding, not him. It's not on his record. So why isn't he getting at least that out of this?
Judge, I agree that he is getting the not being arrested. And if that were on the face of the writing, then the argument would probably fail just by having that on the face of the writing.
On the face of the writing, let's assume that you have to have it on the face of the writing for purpose of my question, but I mean, don't you at least escape the having on your record the charge of speeding, which is on the face of the document now? That you're being summoned to appear in court on such and such a day, being charged with speeding by the officer. But if you sign someone else's name and you get away with it, then that's not going to be on your record as having been charged with speeding.
Right. And I think the difference is that in the analogy of the check and then sort of the traditional forge and utter, the person who was being prejudiced was the person who was receiving the writing in some kind of way. the officer's not being prejudiced. Surely this other person is, but there's no prejudice to the officer. So there's that breakdown where the one act of signing a summons, where it's not explained what that act is, as opposed to when one signs a check, it's very clear that one is making this promise. You know.
Well, these are two different statutes, though. The general forgery and uttering statute, and then the uttering of a public document. And I think it was Campbell versus Commonwealth. The Supreme Court said that elements such as intent to defraud or prejudice of another's rights are not elements of forgery of a public document. Doesn't that kind of mitigate against some of the arguments that you're making based on the general forgery case law?
It certainly would. I don't think I read Campbell. I do think that Commonwealth cited Campbell, but I don't think I got around to reading Campbell. I think that would change my argument a little bit. I didn't start my timer. How am I doing on time?
You've got about 4 minutes before.
Oh, 4 minutes. Okay.
Your rebuttal.
Yeah. Thank you, Judge. Well, that's an interesting question. That's very interesting. I would say, in response to that, that the writer doesn't have any knowledge of that, and so unlike in Bennett, where the writer, the forger, is trying to obtain an object, trying to get the license, the writer in the case of the summons is not trying to get anything. He doesn't know he's trying to get anything. It's not on the face to say that that signing the summons, is in exchange for not being arrested, or signing the summons, even if it's said, can be considered, you know, uttering. So there was some, you know, so they knew what the signing was. The signer is merely offered a piece of paper to sign, having given the false identity, committed that crime, having forged it, commit that crime. He hasn't done anything else except for that, in that signing. And you know, the Commonwealth complains that it would never be an uttering. And that, I don't know necessarily why that would be so bad, because he's clearly committed the felony of forgery, and why one act should necessarily be two offenses is not clear to me. But it would be, as I said before, it would be easy to fix by just putting that language on the front of it so that the person who was doing the signing knew that this was he was getting something in exchange for his writing. I don't think that Bennett, the holding in Bennett, they rely on, I think, the fact that he's getting something in their analysis. The fact that a document was being generated was critical to that analysis. And
the statute actually has two separate components. It's uttering or attempt to employ as true. Why wasn't this an attempt on the part of the defendant to employ as true this summons to the police officer?
Well, I think that's one reason why the statute is why it's problematic on the summons. So the case law involving the community service reports, for example, where the person fills out a community service report and then offers that to the court, that is an employing as true that I've done this work. He has just made a statement. He's just signed it and promised to appear, and that's his address. So I don't see this the same kind of action that is in the check analogy, and certainly that is in the community service analogy, where there's something being offered that is employing that false thing as true. I mean, he signed a name, and I don't think his awareness of don't think a defendant has an awareness of that being anything more than just signing somebody else's name.
Right, Mr. Barron, you're into your rebuttal. You may continue or reserve as you wish.
I'll reserve the balance.
Thank you. Ms. Tyson?
Yes, may it please the court. This was an uttering of a public record. I think it is important that in Sands, the word that was used by the court in Sands was not object but money, because it's a very different case. I understand that this court in Bennett cited to Sands. Our argument on brief, and I'll say it again today, is that that is dicta, because many, many years after Sands, the Virginia Supreme Court in Bateman gave the definition of utter as assertion by word or action that a writing known to be forged is good and valid. And the holding in Bennett is that the uttering was completed simultaneously with the forgery because the forged signature on the electronic screen was being employed as true in order to generate the false public record, which, of course, the defendant did not get. The phrase obtaining the object that is said in the writing is not something that the Commonwealth has to prove in uttering a public document. And it is, I agree that we have argued that you would never be able to utter a summons. And we know that a summons is a public record. We know that from this court's case in Rodriguez. It was not an element that had to be proved that the defendant was gaining something that was expressly listed in the summons. Now, we did noted in our brief that as far as the seatbelt and the speeding are concerned, it's right on there that if you sign and you check the box, you can actually avoid coming to court completely. But that's really not the real issue here, is that the uttering was completed when the defendant, after having signed a false name, gave that summons to the deputy as being correct, knowing that it was forged, because what he did was he offered it to another as genuine, also a phrase that we find in Bennett. Yes? Oh, okay. I think this language is dicta. The model jury instruction, which I pulled out, does not, yes, the model jury instruction does use with intent to defraud, but it doesn't say to obtain the object mentioned in the writing. And again, Sands had to do with money, and I think that it's not as good a fit, and I think because it was dicta in Bennett, it is not binding for the uttering of a public record in this case.
Your argument is that it was dicta in Bennett, but your argument isn't that it was dicta in Sands, right? Because in Sands, that's what was being obtained, was the money.
Well, and I tell you, I'm not sure that it really survives even in the other kind of, in the regular forgery and uttering. And the reason I say that is that about 50 years or so, or 90 years, after Sands, in Bateman in 1964, when the Supreme Court was defining uttering again, they did not include that in their definition of uttering. And that was not uttering of a public document. That was your basic forgery and uttering. So I think it has, and for the purposes of our case today, I think that it has no place in the uttering of a public record. Now, that having been said, the trial court here considered that argument and I think correctly determined that, in fact, by uttering this forged summons, that there was a benefit, and the benefit was that the defendant could avoid being arrested, and the trial court was correct. This court in Hines had a long portion of that opinion which addressed how one can avoid an actual physical arrest by signing the summons. So that brings us down to the argument is, because it doesn't say on the face of the...
I mean, if he had signed his own name, he would have avoided the arrest, right? Whether he signed Christopher Venable or his own name, he would have avoided having to go with the officer to see the magistrate or the police station, been arrested, whatever the next actual step would have been. But is there a problem with that as far as getting something in return, or is it that he avoided being charged, at least at that point, and having on his record the speeding violation that is now on someone else's record or a fictitious person's
record? Right. And in fact, those cases were not crossed against Christopher Venable, who I guess is actually a real person. Well, I think, though, at the moment that he did this, the writing itself is false. It is a forged writing. And he then utters that forged writing, and by presenting that forged writing, he does avoid going with the magistrate at that time. I understand Your Honor's point, that whatever name he had put down, even if he put his own name down, that he would have avoided being arrested. He did avoid being arrested, and as Your Honor said, he did avoid also the charges by using that false name. But at that moment in time, he did avoid arrest, and by uttering this document, and it was a forged document, and he knew it was a forged document when he uttered it. And so I think the trial court's reasoning stands up. I think Your Honor has presented yet even another reason why he did obtain something, if that even is an element here of uttering a public record. Because once he offered this as being true, and he knew that it was not true, and he was offering it knowing full well that it was not true, he was going to avoid being arrested on that day and was going to avoid being charged with these offenses himself, because someone else was going to be charged with those, even if only temporarily.
Does the record indicate anywhere that he was afraid of being arrested if he gave his own name, such that perhaps there was arrest warrants out for him that he might have been aware of? I didn't see that anywhere.
No, I'll tell you what is in the record is that, of course, he tries the same thing again in Waynesboro at a later date on a drunken public charge, and it's only because someone at the police station or the jail in Waynesboro recognizes who he really is, but the ball gets rolling in finding out he's not Christopher Venable from New York, but he's really Mr. Goodwin from Virginia. So for whatever reason, he had picked out Mr. Venable as being the name he was going to use when he got into trouble with the law. He did continue that, and that's the way that the deputy in this case actually found out who he was, because the officer from Waynesboro contacted him, and they were able to determine that he was not Christopher Venable, but that he was Mr. Goodwin instead.
Does the record indicate whether he had a driver's license or identification that he provided the officer?
Now, he told the officer, when the officer first stopped him, he got out of the car and he put his hands behind his back and said, "I don't have a license." And, of course, the response from the deputy in Augusta was, "Well, that's not really that big a deal." And so he gave him one of the summonses was for no operator's license, as well as speeding and the seatbelt.
Did he present any other type of identification?
I do not believe so. And, in fact, part of the problem for the government in Augusta was that their checking system was down, and the officer was unable to check out-of-state information. And so that was a reason that this particular fraud was, he was able to perpetuate that fraud in this case. So the short answer, I think, is that no, he did not present identification of any type to the officer. I did want to touch on one other argument, and I'm reluctant to do it because Mr. Barron didn't bring it up in his original argument, but just in case the court had any questions with regard to whether there was an act of providing this summons, whether the defendant handed it to the officer or the officer took it from him, we argued in our brief that this actually is an argument that is barred under 5A18 because it was not raised to the trial court in the motion to strike arguments, etc., and that, in fact, the defendant in his motion to strike said, "Well, I think the Commonwealth's theory is by handing it back to the officer while maintaining this pretense that it was uttering." It's clear from pages 35 through 37 that the prosecutor argued the defendant handed the item back to the officer. The trial court at page 41 found that the defendant handed it back, and frankly, handing it back and taking it are not mutually exclusive acts. The deputy could have taken it back as it was handed to him. I would just point out, in case the court is interested in considering this argument, that when the deputy testifies on direct in his own words, he testifies that the defendant handed the papers back to him. On cross-examination, when he is asked about this, he agreed that he took it back. But even if he took it back, the act of uttering still occurred, because, as we noted earlier, the definition is to offer to another as genuine, and by assertion, by word or action, that a writing is known, that is known to be forged, is good and valid. And so even if you just allow the officer to take that to you, you are representing that it is valid and that it is good, and knowing full well that it is a forgery. So it would be our position that all of the elements of uttering a public record were satisfied in this case, and that the trial court was correct as a finder of fact in finding the evidence sufficient to establish those three charges of uttering of a public record. And I, of course, would be happy to answer any additional questions that the court would have with regard to this case.
Any further questions?
Counsel, I've got a question. In terms of Rodriguez,
yes,
an application of this court's decision in Rodriguez,
yes,
how would you characterize footnote 3 in Rodriguez?
Footnote 3 in Rodriguez.
It's where,
okay,
where the uttering issue is discussed by the court.
Right. In Rodriguez, the only issue in Rodriguez was I didn't commit a forgery, so I can't utter it, because he said his brother's name, and then he had something illegible on the document itself. And this court found that it was sufficient, it was a sufficient forgery, and therefore it could be an uttering. But the reason, of course, we relied on Rodriguez was for the fact that a summons is a public record. It is a public document. But the argument in Rodriguez, of course, was quite different, in that the whole basis of the there is no uttering is because there wasn't actually a forgery. So it's quite a different issue than was presented in this case.
Thank you.
All right.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Mr. Barron, you have 5 minutes remaining.
Judge, I would say that I think the appellant would agree with the Attorney General's position with respect to the taking or the offering. And I don't think that I or Mr. Judy intended to make a distinction with this took them back language on page 6. It is a sort of an involuntary exchange between the person who stopped and the officer, but I don't think that was that made the difference, because certainly the if the writing had an object on it that the appellant was trying to obtain, whether or not the officer reached and took the papers from him, or whether he handed them back to the officer, I don't think would make a significant difference in that kind of legal analysis. So I think I would agree with her, with the Attorney General on that. But as far as Bateman is concerned, the court is trying to decide whether you can be found guilty of all three in the context of a check type document, where you can be found guilty of forgery, uttering, and the obtaining money by false pretenses. And so it defines forgery, and it defines uttering in the first line, not cited by the Attorney General. The word utter is defined in Black's Law Dictionary as meaning to put or send as a forged check into circulation, to utter and publish. It's an assertion by word or action that writing known to be forged is good or valid. And then, so that sort of goes back to the forgery, that there's a writing with the intent to defraud, and that goes back to that what is in Sands, which I don't think is necessarily dicta in Sands, and I don't think it was dicta in Bennett, because the fact that there was this document being generated by the DMV as a result of the signature that he didn't wait around to get, but that he signed to generate, was being was being created, so that was something that he was going to receive. And so our argument is basically that without any object being on the face of the object, without the writer knowing what he's doing, knowing that he's putting, he's getting something in return for this writing, it shouldn't be an uttering. It makes sense in the case of a check why that act can be, why you can be convicted of all three in the case of a check of the obtaining the money as well. It doesn't seem to make sense in the context of a government document that you necessarily do both when you sign a false name on it. Certainly, there would be situations where you do, for example, the community service sheet. But when you sign a summons, the fact that you are necessarily committing two offenses is not obvious when there's nothing on the face of the document to indicate that is what is happening. And I think that's the basic argument that the appellant is offering, that I'm offering on behalf of the appellant. And I'm happy to answer any questions for the balance of the few seconds that I have.
Any additional questions, judges? All right. Thank you very much for the questions. Thank you very much for your argument. We will adjourn and reconvene in conference.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.